Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a house.
Hello, everybody. Saxon Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 29. NASDAQ Futures down 160. Dow Futures down 168. As we continue to have all kinds of crazy stuff going on here in the world, as our president is now calling. What's the story is? That jerk will be gone soon. Speaking of, that jerk will be gone soon. Fed independence. There you go. It's nice to have somebody who's in control of their emotions in the White House. But anyway, we do. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, who's the jerk?
Powell, evidently.
Oh, okay.
I would be interesting to see if, you know, if Powell doesn't resign... Trump's got to pick a new chairman from the guy who's on the board. His Powell's term as chairman is up in May, but his term as a board member is not up for like another year or two.
Okay, so he can stay around and be a thorn in the president's side for a while.
Well, somebody has to be. I mean, anyway. Hey, what'd you make of it? We listened yesterday. What'd you make of this? I don't know why this gambling platform thing has me kind of fixated, but. I can't believe that somebody could, if they knew what was going on, they would make out on both sides of this. I don't know if you were listening to that yesterday. The market on whether there was going to be, where you could bet on, I guess you could bet on anything, right? You could bet on whether Maduro was going to be out with expirations January, February, and March. And you could bet on whether the U.S. was going to invade. So evidently somebody plunked down $30,000 on whether Maduro was going to be out, and whatever the odds were, it's got to be what, 11 or 12 to 1, he or she made $430,000. But there's $10 million that was bet on the U.S. was going to invade, and evidently their story is that it was not an invasion, so they're not paying that part off. So the people who bet the 10.5, whoever they are, of course, are amazingly pissed off. Polymarket was approached for comment. On its website, the platform states that the bet refers to U.S. military operations intended to establish control. President Trump's statement that they will run Venezuela while referencing ongoing talks with the Venezuelan government does not alone qualify the snatch an extract mission to capture Maduro as an invasion. But the interesting part of this platform, and the part that I don't know if people necessarily understand what I'm talking about, is it's sort of like buying stocks. I mean, if you go to make a bet on the Bears on FanDuel, or who's the other guys? The other online gambling platform. You're making your bet with FanDuel.
There's a whole bunch of them, yeah.
I mean, you're making your bet with FanDuel, right? So they're on the other side of essentially your trade. But if you put some money here at PTI or any place, Merrill Lynch or something, and you want to buy 100 shares of IBM, we or they facilitate that order, and you buy it from another person or a fund or somebody.
Or multiple people, yeah.
Yeah, and so...
In other words, you have to go out and acquire the stock for that person to buy at the price the person wants to buy, pay for it.
Well, evidently, the Polymarket works the same way. If you want to bet there's going to be an invasion, somebody else, Lou or somebody, is on the other side of the bet. Polymarket is just, they're acting like as a brokerage firm, which is a little strange for something like that. But so if somebody were to know, if there really wasn't, if there's an insider that knew exactly what was going to happen, essentially that person would be winning on both sides of his bet. And a huge advisor to this place is Trump's kid. Kevin, you can't write fiction like this. Now, I'm not saying he was involved or whatever, but how the hell did he get to be an advisor of this place? Are they everywhere? I think one article said he's on the board. I can't confirm that. One article said that, the other one didn't. This one says he's a, what the hell do they call him? What the hell is the bottom line here? The bottom line is, after all, the bottom line, right? I'll find it. I don't know. It says he's something here.
The question is it Don Jr. or is it?
It's Don Jr. He's something. He's either an advisor or he's on the board.
Eric, one of
the, and I don't know if they're an investor in a place or what. But $10 million, and there's going to be an invasion, and then all of a sudden it's not an invasion. But $10 million is kind of a lot of money for something like that, don't you think? And who the hell would take the other side
it
of
it? It is, but do you know about how much I care about the betting markets?
Well,
for this kind of stuff,
I wouldn't care either, except on something like this. It seems like the only people involved would be somebody who thinks they know something, whether they do or they don't. I think they do.
Apparently, a whole lot of people who thought they knew something didn't.
Well, I guess when you start dancing in the head of a pin on what exactly an invasion is, I don't know. I don't know if I'd call it an invasion or what I'd call it exactly, but. Extraction?
An invasion would indicate that, you know, they capped military presence there.
I would think so, too, actually. Anyway, so, Trader, there's still $10 million hanging out there on invasions this year.
Not all that interesting.
Well, everything to me, everything that Trump and his family have found their way into is interesting to me, because what are they doing with this stuff? I mean, this, whatever. Hey, I had a question for you. Well, let's talk about sports. I was watching a little bit of that. The games are kind of blurring together. But did it strike you at all? I watched bits and pieces of every game. Did it strike you at all that there had to be a memo from the commissioner to not call any head-to-head hits? I probably saw 10 of them that during the season would have been easily a penalty and maybe tossed out, and not one of them was even called. The announcers are going, wait a minute, that was helmet to helmet.
The announcers were criticizing a lot of stuff, and rightfully so, I thought. Head-to-head hit doesn't necessarily mean that it's a penalty, but there's a good chance that it'll be a penalty. It sort of depends on, you know, whether the guy leads with it, crown of the helmet, all that kind of stuff that comes into play. But I don't know if they had a directive that said, "Hey, let's keep it light because we don't want some of these penalties deciding games, getting guys thrown out, et cetera." So that, you know, wouldn't shock me.
Well, you could easily have called a head hit on the fumble of Rodgers.
Yeah, you know what? I really didn't watch any of that game, so I can't relate to what you're discussing on that particular case.
Well, I watched a little of the first half. I did not watch. And they seemed like the teams were pretty even, not playing that well, but even. And then I was listening to the, you know, figured somebody might want to talk about it. I started reading the reviews of it, and I saw this big brouhaha on YouTube about this head-to-hit and how it changed the whole game, because evidently somebody scooped up the ball and ran in for, the game was, what, 9-6 or 6-6 at that point or something. And sure enough, Rodgers in the pocket, this guy comes flying in, and whether he did it intentionally or not, all of a sudden he hits this huge right cross on his helmet and out popped the ball. And I'm thinking, God, if there wasn't a head hit on a quarterback in the pocket, and they got the rule in this article right under it, any blow to the head of the quarterback in the pocket is, you know, blah, 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 blah. I'm thinking, that's exactly the definition of the rule. And they didn't call it. And, whatever. Yeah,
depending on the situation. Well, regardless of the situation, a major, a blown major penalty call is a big deal to the game. There are some situations where it's more egregious than others, but it's always a big factor in a game. And I think there is nothing greater than the pass interference 40 yards down the field that winds up being a bad call. To me is a huge problem. This is one area where I actually think college has a better rule, because college caps it at 15 yards. Now, you may tackle a guy 40 yards downfield because he's going to beat you, and he only gets 15 that way, and that's probably a small... I think that's a small price to pay for not having the killer penalty when it goes the other way. It's not a perfect rule, but it at least keeps it from just being a terrible call just... wipes out, actually is game changing. You really don't want the bad calls, and there's just a lot of subjective officiating in football. There's a lot of subjective officiating in many sports, but football more than any other. Baseball, there really isn't a lot of subjective. Now, they may get balls and strikes wrong, they may get safe and out wrong, and they have replay to deal with it, but can be interminable in its own way, but at least that's there is an objective. There's not a lot of judgment calls in baseball. Football, on the other hand, is loaded with judgment calls.
Well, it is, because everybody is also coached to go right to the edge of the rule, and it's a pass interference, even though you're not supposed to jam the guy past 5 yards, so it favors the passing game, and we've seen football change because of that. They got their hands on each other all the way, both guys.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of hand fighting once the ball's in the air.
And the guys are equally entitled to the ball, right? And only it seems like if the offensive guy is kind of pushing the defensive guy, and if he reaches out, the defensive guy reaches out and, grabs the hand just as the ball got there, even though the hand's been pushing him the whole way, well, then that's interference because he can't catch it because you grabbed his arm. So, sometimes it's very obvious, other times it's they're both doing it all the way down, and one guy's like the last person to do it. But there's some stuff that's just kind of like never called. You never see anybody get called for a face mask on a stiff arm. Half the time they grab the guy's face.
No hands to the face when a halfback does it.
What do you think as a organizational professor? What do you think of the idea that I believe, now I'm not positive on this, that the refereeing groups work as a team during the year, then they take the individual people they think are the best and make a team for the playoffs? Do you think that's a problem? I think I might think that is a problem.
I would think you should have crews. If they're a crew all season long, there should be a crew for the playoff game. That makes sense to me.
Well, quick story. The late Freddie Wheaties, guy who worked for Pershing and was a broker next to me in the OEX bit, terrific guy. He was a big Illinois fan, right? So every year for a period of about 5 years, we would go to an Illinois game, because we're buddies of Freddie's, and he put this thing together, and blah, blah, blah. So this one year, we're going down to Ohio State, and Freddie's got the tickets, the worst tickets ever. Well, what would you say, Kevin, if the tickets were down low at one end, not in the end zone, where you couldn't see anything except the 20 yards in front of you, but the cheerleaders are right in front of you? So that was our compensation. We got to watch the cheerleaders, but we didn't see 80%. Anyway, so we get to Columbus. It is raining like you've never seen rain, right? At the airport, the pilot lands in this rain. The river is within about 100 yards of the stadium at this point. Anyway, so we pile out, and there's four of us, and there's one cab. Of course, I'm the tall guy, so. And there's this other dude goes, "Hey, guys, can I pile in with you? There's no other cabs," and everybody's grumping. So I, of course, grab the front seat, and I go, "Sure," being the knucklehead that I am. So the guy piles in the back seat. Now, all the guys in the car are Mr. Sports. Matter of fact, they were the first three guys that were on sports, the sports guys on TV show. They were the predecessor of the sports writers on TV and cable. Anyway, so they get, it turns out the guy in the back seat with him is going to be one of the officials for the next day's game. So now they're in seventh heaven talking to this guy, even though the guy's laying across their laps. And he starts talking about different people and different coaches. And I think he was, I don't think he was a referee, but I think he said the three people that always worked together, if I can remember this, were the referee, the head linesman, and I think the, not the back judge, who's the other guy? Yeah, the back judge. Because they always work as a team, and you fill in around them. Now, why would that be? I mean, why would you suppose those are the three key guys?
Don't know, because I never pay much attention to what the delineation of responsibilities is for them.
Well, I know the referee takes care of everything with the quarterback, and is it the left tackle? The umpire who stands on the other side does the interior line, right? The head linesman watches the other tackle, I believe. And I don't know how the back judge and the field judge, I don't know how they delineate what they're doing. But there are specific guys you're supposed to be watching, right?
Right.
And I don't know why the choreography is, because whenever you see a roughing the pass or whatever, that's always the referee's flag, right? Because he stands behind the quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and side judge gets on offsides and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there's specific responsibilities.
But he's not the head linesman anymore. What's his new name?
Don't know.
Yeah, he's something else. Anyway, why do you think there is such a major brouhaha with this Fed thing when the guy's only there two more meetings and they're gonna lower rates anyway? What's the big deal?
I don't know. You know, people are pissy about each other, so it's personal.
Well, I heard this. I had a quote yesterday from a French general, and he says, "Do you realize that if you listen to what's going on, in a month we could be fighting the Americans?" He goes, "What are we doing here?" He goes, "The idea of somebody in NATO attacking somebody else in NATO." This has been 80 years of peace. What are we doing? I'm listening.
Is he really serious that he thinks people are going to be fighting, the French are going to be fighting?
Why does everybody think to not pay attention to this guy? Well, if we invade Denmark, what is everybody else going to do?
We shouldn't have to invade Denmark.
We should just be able to take it?
Well, buy support from the citizens. Give everyone $1 million. It only costs you about as much as... Oh, maybe two or three nursing home frauds in Minneapolis. So it's not expensive in the scheme of things.
Why don't we just leave them alone?
Lives there $1 million and call it a deal.
Does anybody other than Trump wants it? Does anybody have any idea? Is there anybody in this country who really wants Greenland other than him?
I think most people don't care very much. I get the strategic importance of it, and I think that do we care about influence? Do we care about policy? Or do we care about control? I don't know.
We have a base there.
Hasn't Trump always just, bargained, by opening with the outrageous and then coming back to something a little normal? Pretty much.
The style's getting a little crazier every by the week, it seems to me. Just saying. I mean, I don't know what we're doing in Venezuela. Does anybody? And I'm wondering how it's going to affect, obviously I look at this stuff every day. How is it going to affect world markets? How is it going to affect? I see some of the stuff that's happening with Canada, and I see a degrade here. I mean, the tourism is way down. People are down on that. I see Canada has completed their pipeline to Vancouver, and now they're shipping their liquid natural gas to other people without using us. So if you and I were in that business, we'd go, now what are we supposed to do? I mean, some of this stuff is hurting people here. It's not helping them. What if I had some clients in the natural gas, we had LNG natural gas, and all of a sudden they're not getting the Canadian gas to send out? Well, hell, if the stock's down or whatever, I don't want that happening to my people.
You don't.
I mean, they're completing some rail line. I don't know where the rail's going, but they want to export all their own grains without coming through here. Some they have to. They bought the Canadian National owns the old IC, so they still have the way to get the grain to New Orleans for the stuff going the other way. But I mean, do we really want to shut these people out in these markets? I don't know what the goals are. I really don't. I mean, the average Canadian spends $9,000 a year on American stuff. The average American spends $1,200 a year on Canadian stuff. Now there's more Americans, obviously. But how exactly are we getting screwed by these guys? I never got that point. I never got that so much.
Have you ever listened to Trump do like an hour-long interview?
Don't start with that, please.
Like, why?
Because
that's where you get the answers to this.
No, you don't. No, you don't. Because somebody writes up something.
Yet you refuse to listen.
I listen all day long to the guy.
In sound bites.
Okay. Okay. And I the idea that somebody somewhere gathers this up and tells him to say something. He can't even do that anymore, though. Yesterday he was trying to do that, and he just went off on a binge yesterday. I don't think he could do an hour interview now. Anyway.
He just did one last week.
Okay. And he was saying, and somehow, someplace.
Yeah, it was measured. It was interesting.
There's, when the people who support Trump, okay,
you just asked the question.
The people who support Trump, is it really about Trump or the fact that they supported him?
Or is it really about ideology? I don't know.
What?
I can't speak for everybody else.
All right. Well, what do you think is going to happen to the oil business? I mean, are you a buyer of oil or not? Because I'm asking this because we've had people in silver and gold, and it still seems like it's running up here. Matter of fact, silver's up another $4 today after being. And we're chasing that, boy. I mean, we've sold some calls that we're chasing. So that's, even though we're making money in there, we're really making money in the GDX and the GLD. But what do you think oil's doing here? Would you be a buyer of like the XLE this year as the oil companies? Is this thing with Venezuela going to be accretive or not? Or was oil still at $58? Doesn't seem like it's moving at all.
I think it's all up in the air. If I had expertise in the industry, I might have a strong opinion. But at the moment, I don't. So I wouldn't go diving in where I don't know what's going on.
Well, it has to do with the. A lot of it has to do with the refineries and the oil they can produce, and the fact that the some of the fracking oil does not match up what our refinery capacity is. and so I don't know how that all is going to play out, but this guy who just bought the Citgo out of bankruptcy of all places, he owns the 10 refineries on the Gulf Coast that are set up for Venezuelan oil. Remember the story there where Chavez... Remember that deal, Kevin? It had to be... I want to say my stepfather's dead... 17 years when he was in the Mantino home, and there was remember the big fiasco between with Citgo, and because Chavez bought a big chunk of Citgo, didn't he? The Venezuelan government did. So we were boycotting Citgo oil. Remember that gasoline?
It was a long time ago, but sure.
I'm saying, yeah, this is a long ago story. These stories never seem to go, do they? They come back. Well, evidently, the Citgo part here owns these refineries that were taking mostly Venezuelan oil, and that's why Chavez had wanted to buy them. And they've been not doing so hot. I mean, I don't know the whole history of it, but evidently they've been in bankruptcy for a while, Citgo USA. And this guy, Singer, who's, again, a big proponent of Trump and a big contributor to campaign, buys this place out of bankruptcy for something like $5.5 billion, where evidently, the value was 10 or 11. No, who knows what it is now. So anyway, he buys this thing out of there. And all of a sudden, like a week later, we yank this Maduro and say we're getting all this Venezuelan oil. And guess where it's going to go? To this guy's refineries. But they have been. Those refineries have been doing lousy. They were the first thing that they were going to try and fix that was this pipeline that got torpedoed. Because evidently, the Canadian tar sand oil is somewhat similar to Venezuelan oil. It's probably worse, but it's the heavy crude. I think Saudi is kind of heavy crude, and I don't think we get much oil from Saudi anymore either. So if you're a refinery setup, You couldn't shove this stuff into the the refinery at Whiting and have the refinery not work, right? Or work properly, because every refinery is set up for a certain kind of oil. Now, whether they can move a little bit or not, you know, I'm not a chemist, but I don't think you can. There's huge differences in the oil, I think, and that's why when you say they're smuggling oil, I think, Kevin, somebody, you know, with a bachelor's in chemistry could take a big hypo out of that oil and tell you where it came from. And I think it would be really hard to smuggle oil and say it's somebody else's oil. I think they know right where it comes from, don't you?
Yeah, probably.
So anyway, starting the new year, what are your topics? I mean, we have Alva is going away from economic thought into macroeconomics, and he's all fired up about that. Larissa's teaching a lot of hedging and for people, you know, risk management and so forth, which has got to be, I think, interesting as hell. What do you think this year is a subject everybody should be zeroing in on?
Well, I would zero in on, you know, watching where, and I am technology centric for teaching purposes, but I would zero in on technology. As I've said before, AI, such as it is now, and it's not, I wouldn't really call it intelligence per se, but what it is it's really the state of AI right now is just really, really fast processing, doing things that humans can do, but doing it really fast. And I think the emphasis for the technology is in the use cases. How are people and how will they start using it? And that means, what kinds of applications are being developed and who are the companies providing the applications to do it. And you're seeing a lot of it get integrated into ERP systems. So you're seeing Microsoft, you're seeing SAS, you're seeing Oracle and NetSuite, but you're also seeing a lot of the smaller ERP providers, you know, Odoo and Sage and people like that who deal with the mid-sized manufacturing companies, and you're seeing them integrating a lot of the stuff in there. So whether it's a demand planning app, whether it's better routing, whether it's better, more efficient warehouse layouts or production line layouts, you know, all those kinds of things, all the things that ERP systems have been tracking, now you start applying the processing power behind AI to it. And you really start getting a real big payoff on it, and some of the technology is video. So you use things like digital twins. What that means is, if I want to put a digital copy of my production lines into a computer and now start running models about how I can do this more efficiently, that's it. I also think the other area to watch is who is newly making a real commitment to lean and quality management techniques, because in the end, the customers don't give a crap about what their provider's cost structures look like. They care about what they're willing to pay, what they consider value for products. And that's what they're willing to pay. And if your prices are up, whether it's because of tariffs, whether it's because of higher costs that from inflation that we've felt in the last few years, whatever the reason, that's not their problem, and they'll tell you that that's not my problem. My problem is that I don't see the value of paying more for your product. And when you have, and I encounter this all the time. I encounter companies that say, well, our goal for this year is to get our first pass yield, the number of things that come down our production line and they're correct the first time. My goal is to get that to 95%, which means they're probably in the 80s. Well, that even if you meet your goal, that means 5% of what you make, you can't sell. And you either have to rework it, which is adding expense to your process, or you scrap it, which is means you're making things twice to sell one. Or if it slips out your factory door and you ship it, now you not only have to make it again to make good with your customer, but you pay to ship it out, you pay to ship it back, and there's a cost to pissing off your customers, so you have that deal.
Any company
that's not dedicated to fixing all of that stuff is not going to survive.
Well, Kevin, where's the cash in here? When I say that, I mean, I will say that when AI first started, when you say you do something stupid like I do, when you put down NVIDIA earnings revenue per share, and I'll Google that. Well, the AI used to come up with a number that was all screwed up, and I would always just go right to Yahoo or some of the places, and I'd go through the calculation myself, and I want to be correct. And all of a sudden, over the last year, the AI is pretty much spot on to now the point where, I believe it. They actually do the calculation like I would do it, or somebody's doing it. But I'm not paying for that. It just means I don't have to go to Yahoo, or whether it attracts some Yahoo or not, I don't know. And every day I see, I'm watching a screen here with a gazillion stocks on it. It seems like some of these companies, they're almost like pairs trades. Like, I'll explain what that is in a minute. Where you'll see one day, like Oracle and maybe Adobe and somebody else are way up, and a few others are way down. Then the next day, like maybe Microsoft is up and something else is down. And somehow, someplace, there must be information where these companies do different things or whatever, but you'll see one way up and one way down on the same day. And it's always a few of them seem to be kind of paired together, which I don't know. I have no idea the reason for that. And I was actually, who was asking the question the other day? We're talking about, the episode here with Oracle, where the stock was, I'll kick up the chart, the stock was... It was low there for, it was at like 225 here in September. Then they had the deal where they were going to get TikTok and something else going to happen. They were going to cut some deal with the government, and the rumors all over the place was that Donald Jr. and Ellison's kid are big buddies or whatever. And all of a sudden, the government.
No, that's Wayne's rumor. That's not a rumor I've ever heard.
Okay.
Okay. Go on.
So the stock shoots up to 325. Okay, so, that's a number. It goes up like 50%. And then all of a sudden it gets up there, hacks around in the 300s for a while. And now it's below where it was when it started. Now, I guess if you're going to do this, you better get out quick. But it seems like now there'll be days when Oracle is up and, like, Microsoft or somebody's down. Now, yesterday, Microsoft was down a bunch and AMD was way up. And I don't know enough about what these guys all do differently where... If somebody like you said, say an expert in the field comes out and says, well, we're using this kind of AI where one of them would be down and the other one would be up, but are they all just competing, and are there two or three of the companies are kind of on one track and two or three on the other track, or what?
Yeah, there's companies that are hardware centric, there are companies that are software centric. You'd probably consider Oracle a little of both as an example. Because Oracle has historically always been a database company, and that's kind of their bread and butter. But you better have a database that can crunch a lot of numbers really fast. Think of all the data that's out in the world, Tom. Because if you want to do really good demand planning, you want to get really good at it, and not just say, well, it's going to be last year plus 5% or last year plus 3%, because that's just a wild guess. If you want to be really good at it, you want to see what the trends are and so on, think of the places where you have to collect data. You're going to be out in social media land, for example, collecting data. How unstructured is that? Mm-hmm. You and I could post the exact same thing on a social media website, the exact same thought, and it looks completely different. So you need the software that's going to go through, it's going to call through that and start to make sense out of all of these different opinions, stuff with typos, stuff with not. We have the structured data on the company databases. We all know what that looks like, what your general ledger system looks like, all of those kinds of things. That's all structured, but it's all the unstructured data in the world where the real value is. And that is hard to process. And so the companies that have the applications that will do that and have the capacity to do it, because ultimately it does have to turn into something structured that and you have to be able to deal with it. And that's really where an Oracle comes in there. If they can crunch that and turn that into something that is useful for people, because you're not going to send people out to just read everything on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, etc., and say, okay, tell me what's going on. You have to actually have to pull that data, you have to get that data off of there, and somehow turn it into something meaningful and useful that you can use to analyze.
Well, if you look at the Oracle price here, and you just look at the chart, you go, what the hell happened to this stock? And I mean, it had the huge run up, and it came flying back down. And the weird one here is what I ask you about. What is the story with IBM? That was probably the single best performer last year. I'll retract that because I'm not looking at everybody's graph, but the thing was up all year. Started the year at 220, and now it's like 301. And it had a little drop in August, September, but then it came right back up. The only thing I read, and I obviously do a hell of a lot more than this, is they were involved with the Chinese and all this the software where they keep track of their people there and here, which I guess is not the best, but where are they? I mean, I just wonder, you know, if these guys are that in bed with the Chinese, and NVIDIA is that in, now they can go sell their own their chips over there again as this last couple months. I look at that and I see that the Chinese screw around in Venezuela and seemingly getting stiffed on a deal, and I'm wondering, it looks to me like IBM can do way more damage than Maduro can. What is IBM doing? They're doing something really well here. Nobody talks about it.
IBM's doing a lot of things. So the Red Hat acquisition a few years ago was substantial because that got them into different operating systems, which again is more the software world than the hardware world. IBM also runs the most substantial blockchain platform in the world.
Okay,
and so
they do.
They're very integrated into people's supply chains that way because, you know, supply chain is a huge application for blockchain. Way, you know, more substantial as far as I'm concerned, and more interesting and significant than blockchain for cryptocurrencies.
They're never mentioned, though, Kevin. How do they stay out of the news so well? I mean,
they do a nice job of it, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, my hat's off to them for that.
Because I think it's the same question you're asking. People don't understand what they're doing.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm asking. I mean,
pretty hard to report on it if you don't understand it.
Well, I mean, if I come in someday and I see, well, I come in every day, and I see IBM up 3 days in a row, and all of a sudden I see, you know, Oracle in the crapo, and I'm going, okay, well, somebody's doing something good, somebody's not doing something good. What are they doing? You know, it's impossible for me to keep up. Can you keep up? I mean, you obviously are more kept up on it than me, but do you know really what all these companies are doing?
Well, I'm sort of technology focused, and mostly as it pertains to supply chain stuff. So yeah, I'm reading a lot of supply chain journals. I'm getting Supply Chain Digital dropped into my inbox all the time, and you know there's a whole bunch of other ones. I was just flipping through one yesterday, and so it's talking a lot. You know, you get a lot of talk about trends, especially this time of year. What's trending for 2006? What's important? What kind of skills do people need to survive in the way the world's trending? And one of the assignments I have in my supply chain technologies class, the last one, it's called Are You Ready? And I give them a really, really interesting article of the skills you need to be successful in 2035. And I said, what's your gap? What do you have today that you're going to need then? What's your gap and what's your plan for filling in that gap? You know, those are the kinds of things that catch my attention. But I think when you understand what's trending, you know, that's going to inform those kinds of conversations.
Well, what is any of this stuff? I mean, any of the legacy business, is anybody buying mainframe anymore?
Sure.
Now, who would buy something like that still needs it?
Oh, large companies are still, you know, you have a lot of servers, and I think the world has moved on to server class machines by and large, but if you're crunching a lot of big numbers, you need power, you need processing power.
What was the outfit that used to make the was it Cray? Are they still in business?
Yeah, Cray's still around.
Do they still make those massive things? I mean, who uses that? Are they like
computers?
A defense department?
Yeah, although a supercomputer array now looks like a server farm.
Okay, so it's just a lot of other ones yoked together, sort of.
Yeah, it's really more about the operating system than anything else.
Well, it's fascinating stuff.
It makes them all work in unison.
I mean, I would love to have, I mean, you can read this stuff like I try and do, and you can watch all the stock movements. But you know what's weird, Kevin, is you'll see a stock flying down for 3 days in a row, and all of a sudden it flies right back up. It's, I mean, more so than I've ever seen.
Yeah. Let's go back to that Cray array for a little bit, and this applies to a lot of disciplines. What I was describing before about all that freeform data that's out in the world.
Or is Cray still independent, or somebody buying
more in the world in a day than we did for 100 years before it? What you need to do is you pull in all the data, you have to farm it out to multiple processors, so they're all doing essentially the same thing, but they're going through to try and organize the data, and then it has to find its way back to consolidate again once you've made some sense out of all of it. And you know, that's what's in some of the software, and it's really, really complicated to do. And that's the first step in big data analytics.
Well, isn't that where Oracle's, isn't that their strong part of the game? They're into the storage capacity, is that them?
Yeah, they you know, Oracle databases have been around forever, and they've been really good, really expensive. But yeah, the two big database providers are Microsoft for SQL Server and Oracle for their Oracle database. And then Oracle also sells software, so you can get Oracle ERP Oracle NetSuite actually. Among other versions of their software, so they're in that business as well, and you just get all these different companies that are doing multiple things, and it's which one predominates at any given time.
If you had to make a guess on Big Seven versus rest of the market, obviously Big Seven last year was a winner there. Not that there weren't other pieces in the market that did well. Are you a Big Seven fan for 2026, or are they going to come back for a year to the rest of the market, or do the other market catch up?
I think you're going to see, relative to the software developers, the solution developers, to the extent that they can do it themselves, they should. The one that would concern me most, I think, is Apple, although Apple just, you know, announced an AI partnership. We'll see if that amounts to anything. It's who has solutions? Who can go turn all of this processing power? Because processing power is a big enabler. Processing power, cloud is just where do you locate the processing power and how can you get it on demand? That's really what's involved in that. Data transfer speed, 5G, fiber access. You start ticking down the list of all of these hard and important hardware features, or hard, I'll just call them hard features because they're not all computer hardware. And as you start ticking down that list, each one of those enables the next generation of what rolls out. And that's where you're getting real value. I really think this should be the year, this year and next year should be the year of people who provide solutions, who provide applications that can actually do stuff with all of this processing power that we're creating in terms of advancements in chip technology and processors, as well as all of this data center power that we're building out.
Well,
I think it's going to be the people who have solutions who come out and say, "Look, I can come in. We can set this up. We can have you up and running in 3 months, and you'll be doing amazing things."
Now, the people who do that, are they the traditional people, the Accentures of the world, and the big consulting firms? And who does that?
I think it's the more nimble people, honestly. There's a lot of startups. A lot of startups that will get bought, of course. So they get bought by bigger competitors. So that would be something to watch. So I think you're looking at that. I think you're looking at, but you are looking at big companies. You are looking at your Oracles and people like that as well.
And the, I guess I'll call it the politics business front. When you look at these bigger firms, you know, the huge firms, and they are trading at prices that I've never seen for a firm that big. But one thing I think I've learned is don't just assume because you have an opinion that your opinion is right. Every time you make a trade, there's somebody on the other side, right? If I buy a stock, I bought it from a guy eager to sell it to me. Or if I sell it, there's a guy eager to buy it from me. So maybe Maybe the other guy's smarter today than me. I mean, you learn that when you're a trader. Most people...
Yeah. Or more desperate. Could be somebody who's more desperate.
Well, could be. Well, that's what you're hoping, but you don't really know that. Could be you're the one that's desperate, right? Could be a margin call. But you look at these stocks, and you look at, like, an NVIDIA. And, you know, for some reason, I don't really like the guy who runs the place. I think he's playing, you know, countries around like they're chess pieces, and he's doing a pretty damn good job of it, us included. Anyway, now, last week or 2 weeks ago, they just threw out $20 billion and bought someplace. Now, if you think that no matter what the solution is, they're going to be it because they've got the money that's going to go buy the place, and there's only going to be, you know, 30 companies left 10 years from now, it might be an exaggeration, you get a whole different view of valuation than if you just say, wait a minute, these guys look a little pricey. So you can't really divorce the numbers from the political future. I mean, if we are heading down this road, and we've been there heading there for a while, so I'm not just going to blame one person. If we're heading down this road where we're going to become essentially a plutocracy, or we're going to become a fascist economic system, which has nothing to do with concentration camps. It has to do with a few companies in every industry very tied closely, nose up the ass of government. And there's been a lot of countries that have been set up that way, and they think they're doing fine, and maybe they are. But, I mean, it's always been a German way of doing things. French, not so much. Austrian, yes. I mean, it's another way of doing business. It's not, hasn't been our way, but we seem to be heading that way. Now, the people that are involved in it think that that's the better way. But if that's going to continue to happen, every small firm that you just talked about, Kevin, 5 years from now probably is going to have a nice buyout, and they're going to be happy, but they won't be there, which is not my idea of the world. But
they'll begin to lose that scrappiness that made them worth buying.
Well, that's right. But if there's four firms that are getting all the government contracts and are dealing with everybody else, and I'm not saying this is just this is not just a Trump phenomenon. This is, I mean, everybody in the world thinks that competition is the greatest thing for every industry but theirs, right? That's just the way people are. Are there going to be only a few companies of that mega size and a few other people around, you know, just so they say they are? I mean,
I'd like to think not, but I have no faith that that's true.
Yeah, I don't either. And it's you know, if you want to take it to the far end, you won't see anybody on TV because they don't know what the word means. I mean, are we really going to go to a plutocracy where the people who have all the money not only own stuff, but they also own the newspapers, they own everything else, and we're right there. I mean, this was going on before Trump. I mean, how many newspapers now are owned by guys that own big companies? You know, right? I mean, is there really an independent newspaper that anybody pays for? I don't know.
No. Actually, there's a lot of good Substack stuff, and so there is good news and good reporting out there, and you have to be able to pay for it. And some of the reporters have gone away from the major news organizations, and it's gone the other way. You know, CBS hired in Barry Weiss, who, you know, was an independent reporter and a really good one. She definitely leans left, so, you know, that's how it goes. But and I don't care about that. And, you know, I think she's good. I think she's honest, and she's reshaping CBS News a little bit. I don't know if you tuned it in lately, but you know, CBS Nightly News is a little bit different, and their ratings are showing it. But I also think you have your Matt Taibbi's and people like that who are out there just operating independently because they don't want to be constrained anymore by the networks. Cheryl Atkinson is doing that. What's her name? Catherine Herridge, who used to work for CBS and used to work for Fox. So she's been on the left and the right side of the news media, but she does great reporting. And, you know, I would recommend that people subscribe to them. They're not very expensive, and they give you some really interesting stuff.
Well, why can't a newspaper? I mean, is it the newspaper's fault or the fact that everybody who's online thinks everything ought to be free?
Oh, probably some of each. But I will tell you where it's the newspaper's fault is there's still a mini revolt that CBS News is trying to manage, because there's a lot of people that they just do not support the Barry Weiss move. because, you know, she's not letting us do what we used to do, which was very biased reporting.
In one person's mind, I mean.
Well, I think in a lot of people's minds.
Okay. I mean,
Come on, they're the ones who got sued for selective editing.
Well, give yourself 15 minutes of Newsmax and tell me they're not biased, or Fox.
Yeah, I understand. I think there's some good reporters on Fox. I don't watch Newsmax, so I couldn't tell you what's there. But I think Fox has some good reporters, and they have reporters that don't interest me at all.
In the interest of,
and I really don't watch a lot of Fox either. So,
well, in the interest of trying to look at both sides of this stuff, I go on YouTube and I'll see something about, you know, Trump totally blows up today or something or other. And once in a while I go, you know, I want to listen to just what this idiot has to say. Kevin, there's never anything there on either side. Either it's the you go through this whole spiel and there's nothing that leads, like the headline says, there's no evidence of anything on either side. I mean, why do people listen to this stuff? If you go in there with just any kind of a point of view where you just, okay, what do you got? What do you got for me that you made that outrageous claim? There's never anything there on either side.
Yeah, headlines often don't match the content.
And I'm sitting there going, God, yet somehow or another, the guy has a studio and he has some kind of a platform. I mean, what does it cost? I mean, that stuff costs money. I mean, it costs to get Stocks and Jocks on the air, and we don't exactly have a radio studio, but we don't have all the other stuff, camera people. Some of the stuff's pretty professional.
Well, let me offer another thought here too, and that is, I don't care if news reporting is biased. I just don't want them to tell me it's not.
Well,
I'd have to watch it to see, but I don't guess that Newsmax thinks it's independent and unbiased. I think they understand exactly who they are. I think Fox totally understands that it's a conservative point of view. I mean, look at who the evening lineup is. It's, you know, it's Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and people like that. So, you know, that's who they have on there. I don't care if you're honest with me about where you're coming from. I don't care if you're biased. I can filter that out. I can make some sense of it and make judgments about it. It's when you try to tell me that this is in the name of just the facts and it's not, then I call BS.
Well, the facts should be the same on both sides, and they're not.
Yeah, they absolutely should be.
And I'm very, very concerned that, you know, it's been happening, certainly in terms of what's included in the federal deficit. I mean, that started under LBJ, where they took Social Security out of the other stuff and these, whatever. But virtually every, I won't say every president, but for a while, it was like every president made some change in how the budget was recorded, to where the budget's kind of a liar sort of thing. But it was, you know, a lot of people have done it. But now, I think that the control over these numbers, that whether it's just, you know, the final leg of a trip I don't want to see, you know, you can't tell me that this stuff isn't run by the Oval Office now. I mean, these inflation numbers are terrible. The labor numbers, I don't know where they're getting those. I don't know.
I really liked what Hal had to say yesterday about inflation numbers. Maybe that was you. I don't remember, but it was, you know, shouldn't we just be really counting the money supply and call that the inflation number? I think there's a lot to that. Because there are all kinds of externalities that affect prices that really don't have, that aren't controllable and don't necessarily reflect how people consume. What do I care if the price of a really large TV goes up, because, you know, I'm not going to buy one.
Here's where Hal is giving you, there's a formula in economics, it's been around since the Buttonwood tree, right? And it is absolutely true. It's an identity. What it says is that your entire product, your gross domestic product, times the price level is equal to the money supply times the velocity, which is how many times the money supply turns. Now, if you increase the money supply, you're going to end up, and you don't increase the production, what goes up, the price, right? So Hal is absolutely correct in that, but he's forgetting the velocity number. And there's been a thing in economics for a long time that over a long period of time, your velocity stays even. I'm starting to think, and I wish, you know, I could get Milton Friedman out of his grave and a few of those guys. They'd have to educate themselves on the new world. I think a lot of research has to be done. I think the velocity piece, when these guys are making these changes so dramatic, the velocity can actually change in the near term. So in other words, if you poured, and I mentioned this a bunch of times, Kevin, I'd love your critique here before we get to Russell and the other guys, but I'd love your critique. And
Russell's already in, so okay, let's get her.
Well, then I think what happened during COVID, and I mentioned that with Hal yesterday, when I was in grad school and, you know, we were doing the inflation stuff and you know, I'm sitting there listening to Milton Friedman and the guys like him. The whole idea was if you put money into the system, any surge of cash into the system, or withdrawal of cash into the system, but just because the way the system was set up, you know, if the Fed went out and when I say how they put cash into the system, they go out and buy bonds. They take bonds out and they put cash in. So now there's money in people's checking accounts, whoever sold them the bonds, all right? So now there's money in the system. Used to be 6 months was the absolute number on an exam you had to put down with how long it took to filter its way through the system. Because the idea was is your velocity was even, all right? But now in the COVID situation and between the Trump-Biden stupidity combined, and was worse, I don't know, but the combo, they upped the money supply by something like 35 to 40% in 18 months. Other than the Weimar Republic and maybe the Confederacy or Argentina or someplace, Turkey, nobody's ever done that before. So I think in that period of time, Hal would be wrong. I don't, even though we all saw the prices going up, there's no way they went up 35, 40% in 18 months. Now that money has stayed in the market.
Although it did in housing.
Okay, but what I'm saying is not in 6 months. The point I've been making since COVID is they put so much in, it actually took way more than 6 months for it to absorb to where that money was still hurting us 2.5 years later. It took that long to actually get into the system. So what I'm saying in terms of the formula is you poured so much in, the velocity actually dropped. So the price did not go up as fast as you thought, but as time went by, and maybe it's still happening, Kevin, it could very well be, the velocity is creeping back up to, I'll use the term, normal. And while that's happening and the money supply hasn't gone back down, we're still seeing price increases because of the 40% bulge 4 years ago. That's if I was going to write a paper now, that's what I would try and postulate.
Well, whether we're seeing increases because of that or we're just seeing the price level staying at that level,
Another 3%.
It doesn't matter. It's still affecting people. It's still affecting normal people.
Well, the only way we could actually test it, my theory, is if, which they should have done 2-3 years ago after COVID and after they did this, unlike what Trump and anybody else wants them to do that has fixed assets, what they should have done is brought the money supply growth to flat as zero for probably 3 years to sort of catch up, where you could actually look at my theory and see if I was right, if we actually were going to have a runoff, because I think it's a lagging indicator. This is just me. Yeah, this is my.
Nobody wanted to take that medicine, though.
Nobody wanted to take that medicine. So now we're still pushing 3 or 4% on top of the bulge of 4 or 5 years ago. So I don't know how you figure out where the hell you are. I mean, because we now have inflation. I don't think we're having any growth right now. So if we do, if I'm correct, or if it's, say, it's 1%, and we're pushing the money supply at 5, we're pushing another 4% inflation right now, even if we forget about the stuff from 4 years ago. So, I mean, I think what I'm saying is correct, Kevin. I don't know how to tie it all together in some sort of a paper. You know what I'm saying? It was an unusual phenomenon, and I think it took several years. Remember I was saying yesterday how M0 was bigger than M1. The money kicked back to the Fed at night was more than M1, which means that the system couldn't even absorb it, which means that the velocity number actually did go down, I think. So am I being somewhat logical here, am I?
Well, it sounds logical. I actually do think there is some growth in the economy at the moment.
I think there is a little bit.
I don't have the data to back it up.
Well,
there is. Hi.
Hey, how are you? I was hoping you'd pipe in.
Yeah. Good morning. There has been growth in the economy. We are still seeing an expansion. Asset prices are still rising, so there is growth. It's just not necessarily growth across the board, right?
Really, so, that, yeah.
Why do you say asset prices going up is growth?
Because that's one measure of the size of the economy.
Because what I'm trying to get to is if you shove money into the system, how do you even count? I mean, when I was young, you guys are younger. Kevin's not so much younger.
Definitely not.
But back in the 70s and 80s, Larissa, when the inflation was a known problem. I mean, it was a serious problem. People had escalation clauses in labor contracts, and every contract we did at Pullman had an escalation clause in it. I don't know if anybody even knows what that is now, but the idea of in your companies, even Ford and General Motors, they were very specific. Whenever they came out with numbers, profit, they would say sales at GM went up, 8% last quarter. By the way, the amount of cars sales went up 7%. They would try and delineate out the effects of inflation from the amount of widgets. I don't see any of that anymore. So I mean, I don't know how you can determine whether or not we're growing or not by the GDP number when I don't trust the deflator number, I guess is what I'm saying in economic terms.
My point of view on it is I'm just sensing it from talking to people. So that's anecdotal, and that's not necessarily going to show up in the numbers yet. And, when the last couple of months, when we've talked about the ISM numbers for manufacturing, and I keep telling you, it's all over the place. It's not, there's no consistent theme in there that says we're contracting. There's nothing consistent in there that says we're expanding. But there's a little of this, a little of that.
Yeah.
I think, that will shake itself out at some point, and then we'll see what we have going on. But my sense of it in the meantime is that that we are starting to get a little rumbling here of growth in manufacturing activity. We'll also see what the Supreme Court decides on tariffs, because that's going to have an effect on it too.
Kevin, do you think your area and Indiana might be somewhat of an outlier here, Larissa? Is your area? I think that area has done some growth there for a while. You think you're an outlier that you're growing, or you think everybody is? I mean, I don't know how you answer the question, but some people seem like they're doing well, other people maybe not. So how do you tell?
Well, like I said, it's only anecdotally, but go down to Lafayette where Larissa is. There's a lot of stuff going on down there.
Well, it's actually Indianapolis that's really been one of the drivers. I was fortunate to visit the Kelly, they call it the Roadshow, where a bunch of professors go around to different areas in Indiana and talk about the growth of the state of Indiana. And Indiana has had substantial growth in Indianapolis and in storage. So companies will come in and store goods in Indiana. So there has been, and I do believe that Indiana has been an outlier in comparison to our neighboring states with growth in just in our growth for the state of Indiana economy.
It's a great distribution hub, great distribution state. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a lot of warehousing and distribution here. We'll see how it shakes out and if any of the promises are met, but there's a lot of data center growth in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's going to be positive or negative remains to be seen. There's a lot of old line manufacturing, but what I said earlier too about people, have to get leaner, they have to get better, I'm starting to see a little bit more attention to that. I think that's nothing but good.
I agree with you. And to the chief's point about nobody wants to take the medicine, nobody really wants to get leaner. Nobody wants to start making better budgeting decisions. These are real challenges, because we're going to have to change our almost culture around some of these things.
Well, I agree.
And we do have a lot of old line, mid-sized manufacturing companies where what they've been doing for 30 years is, why should I change? But they need to change because they can't afford to operate anymore with, you know, an 80, 89% first pass yield. They just can't do it.
Well, absolutely. And when I was also at the, what is that, the Chicago Fed, they had a meeting in December, and they had a gentleman in the chemicals into space and from Michigan. And one of the things that he was discussing, and I was quite pleased that he was discussing it, they were discussing the challenges of finding qualified labor. And then he further said the challenges of finding qualified labor and then giving them enough wages so that they can actually exist, so that they can afford their bills, so that they can have a comfortable life. And that's something that I think that hasn't been really mentioned by a lot of these different firms is, how does this impact our employees? How do we get them up and ready so that they can be successful in this economy?
Well, so if you had to guess, I mean, I don't think you're hanging around with the people in the admissions department, but what is the...
Oh, God, no, we can't hang around with those people.
But I'm saying, what would you... When Bill Moriarty was on a few weeks ago talking about nobody seems to want to go into civil engineering, what's the chemical engineering draw? I mean, is that... And you guys are an engineering school, obviously. Is that any place anybody wants to be, or they all want to be in computer engineering because they think that's where the money is?
I would not be able to speak to that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder who could give us the number of all the different engineering. I mean, it's one thing to say somebody's going in engineering. It's quite another to say there's got to be, what, 7 different areas? I mean, aerospace, mechanical, electrical. I mean, I'd love to see the breakdown. I wonder if chemical engineering is a sexy spot today. I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. Bill seems to think that civil engineering isn't.
Yeah, and I don't know what to tell you about that, but I do think you are seeing, well, and we'll go back to, you know, the comments about qualified labor. You're starting to see automation. What you're seeing is a lot of automation is now replacing office tasks, or minimizing office tasks. We're used to automation affecting the production line, but now it's affecting purchasing. It's affecting a lot of the transportation activities. As you start to see that, and we talk about getting qualified people, one of the ways that we're doing it is saying, well, if we can't attract enough qualified people, then we have to teach the qualified people we have how to use the automation so that they're more productive. And I do think you're seeing a lot of that.
One of the things, Larissa, I'm not always trying to argue with everybody. I'm trying to make good radio, but I also have one of the oddest ducks on earth in that I have my economic experience, but I also have my cost accounting experience. And aren't too many people that have both of those? It's probably not a good thing to have in the same body. But I always look at things from the bottom up kind of stuff. Everybody talks about the amount of efficiency that all this stuff is going to bring. And yet, I'll read stuff like, who the hell's a speaker? Well, it was Pelosi for a while, now it's Johnson, right? That something like in the late 50s, with typewriters and mimeograph machines, people remember what those things are, the speaker had something like 15, essentially, middle-aged ladies working for him. And they put out X number of bills a year that had to be typed, retyped every time there was a mistake, all had to be redone. And they were putting out in the 50s more bills per year than the guy was, whoever it was, like 10 years ago. And they had like 50 people working there with computers and everything else. And they didn't put out the same product that somebody did with typewriters in 40 years ago. I mean, sometime when you look at this, you know, I would say that the Pullman Treasury Department, they had Pullman Kellogg was there, which is now Kellogg Brown and Root. They had Import-Export Bank. They did Swindell, which made stacks all over the world. There were 6 people there. I'll bet any Treasury Department that big now has 30 in there. And what do they all do all day?
I mean, so I think you're missing that the legislation has changed.
True, I agree.
And I think that adds substantial amounts more of complexity, which requires more people. I think we now are in an environment where we are very cautious of what people are doing. So now you have deeper teams of risk, and those types of individuals didn't exist before. So there has been, over the last 50 years, because of how our economy has changed and because of regulatory oversight, there are things that didn't exist. And now we need to incorporate those, which I think does slow down the system, but hopefully creates better safety checks for us.
Hopefully.
And again, that's something where we can improve how it's done, because as I said, I think last week, what we've done with a lot of what goes on in this economy, whether it's the tax code or whether it's other regulations, is we divert from actually making stuff to things like compliance.
Right.
And compliance, in the lean world, you talk about value added and non-value added. Value added is only stuff that makes your product, that adds something to the product that the customer wants. Now, you may have to transport something from, your receiving area to the production line, but that's not considered a value added. So in the lean world, what you're trying to do is eliminate as much of that, or reduce as much of that as you can, and you're never going to get to 100%, but you can, but you can get there. You can make substantial improvements, and every time you do that, it cuts cost out of your process. As you're doing that, when we talk about compliance, anything that you can do that doesn't require people to spend time doing compliance and still manages to achieve compliance is a good thing, and it's good for the business and good for the cost structure. So I go back to what I said to you earlier about applications. Those are the kinds of applications I'm talking about when you say that, AI is all in the applications. It's in that kind of stuff.
And I agree with you. And Chief, you'll appreciate this. I was also a cost accountant.
Really?
Long, long time ago. And
now, wait a minute. You're only 25.
Right, sure. So in 2001, when Sarbanes-Oxley came out, I was a cost accountant.
Oh, God.
And good portion of my job at that time, which now hopefully nobody else is doing this, but was creating these procedures and processes and documenting everything. And if those procedures and processes are well documented, to Kevin's point, that can be all be automated.
Well,
so
and also
you good systems, then, I mean, you could have essentially eliminated my role.
Well, everybody, I think, knows that you have to do things properly, okay? But everybody also knows that if everybody putting a rivet in the Golden Gate Bridge, if there were two people there to watch them, you never would have finished the thing. And so somehow there's a balance, and I don't know where the balance is, but I think we're kind of over it in some areas. I look at the stuff that goes on even in Nancy and Audrey to come in. If you go to a home closing now, I remember way back in the day when I bought a couple of homes, the first thing you do is put $200-$300 in your pocket and say in case somebody made a mistake and you were $50 off, you just gave the guy the $50, right? Well, now you can't do that. Now somebody has decreed that has to be wired in. Okay, so who's the somebody, and how does that make the world more efficient? We have a lot, like you're saying with Sarbanes-Oxley.
I want to address that point about the $50. I think this becomes a point where we needed regulatory oversight, because if you didn't wire that $50, somebody could easily say, well, I never received the $50, and then it goes to court. And now you're spending all these legal fees for $50.
Well, it used to be people were in the same room, so you wrote down the receipt.
But even with that, it would be easy to contest it in a courtroom. And I think a lot of times
may not win, but anybody can contest.
Right. But the point is, we are trying to get away from those types of costs, which is what creates then these other costs of such as wiring those payments.
I don't know if I really want a regulator to tell me how I can save on costs. You know, have you ever seen anybody who doesn't think that more regulation is always a deal?
Mm. Well, just the people that I know that work for regulatory institutions.
Yeah, I mean, who was berating me last night or the night before that I'm not on Facebook. I mean, these guys from Notre Dame Group sends me all this stuff on Facebook, and I don't open it. And they say, "Why? What are you, some kind of Luddite?" Which I probably am. I'll admit to that. But no, if I go on Facebook, everything I do on Facebook, it's considered, in somebody's ridiculous view of the world, is a communication with a customer.
Right.
And so my brother would have to, which he doesn't need anything more to do. He's our president and stuff. He would have to go through my whole Facebook thing and, you know, somebody sending a picture of what they're having for dinner. I don't need him having to do that.
Yeah. Although you don't have to log in to look at that stuff.
I'm just saying I don't want any part of it. The first thing our regulatory people say every year.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook either. So
no, I mean, why I don't LinkedIn. People send me stuff, and I say they're they can be a friend and send me whatever. But I've never once been on there because somebody's decided they have to look at everything you do. I mean, if you're a client, Larissa, I don't want a text message from you because that means my brother has to go through every single text message. If you send me a text message, I have to say, Larissa, please send an email or call me.
Right.
And you know now that they're itching to find a way where I can't talk to you on the telephone or I can't talk to you in a restaurant. Because that's the hole in the system. I can still talk to you. And you know, there's 58 swinging idiots in this country. It's all they're worried about is me talking to you without them knowing what we're saying. And at some point, we got to say, back off, guys. I mean, I think, but that's just another topic. But it's inefficiencies in the system. Isn't it? I mean, isn't that one of the things that we're concerned about? And you know, Kevin's always talking about efficiency, and so are you. I mean, I think in some areas regulation is a massive problem. I mean, it's gone too far. I think, you know, the idea when Matty Weber got his mortgage, he said his parents had to sign affidavits that they didn't loan him any money in the last year or two or anything like that. Where do people get off on that? I mean, why would anybody think of something like that? But evidently they do. Just saying. I mean, anyway, I don't know how we got off on this topic, but Larissa,
Russell's in. I'm going to drop out.
All right.
I've got to go prep class for this afternoon, so I'm going to do that, and I will talk to you on Friday.
Go on, get out of here so Larissa can tell me what stocks to buy this year.
All right.
Okay. Hi, Kevin. It's nice talking.
It's always good talking to Kevin. We were talking some sports earlier, and what'd you think of the hit on what's his name, the 80-year-old quarterback, the guy in Pittsburgh that whacked him in the head and it wasn't called and the fumble and that changed the game? Were you watching that game?
I did not watch that game.
Did you watch?
I watched the first half of the Bears game, and that was all the football. Well, and the Indiana game, but that was basically all the football I watched over the weekend.
Indiana, you guys look like a pro team. You look awful good.
We look good.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Hey, I have a question for you. And we won't go down to this, but it's again, how you... Russell, hello. It's how
good morning.
How you count, you know, how you count in economics. And, you know, we always talk about it on the show. I don't know why. Because these numbers are all come from someplace. If you listen to Chicago radio this weekend, I'm going to say that every person on there was giddy to the point of having, you know, 15 Viagras they just took to how much money the Bears mean to Chicago, and the bars are packed, and now the ones here are, obviously. And yet we went to dinner, Audrey and I, at a place in Burr Ridge that is normally absolutely, you know, butthole to elbow every Saturday in this bar, and it's the place. Waitresses were going home, there couldn't have been five people in the place. Because they weren't, you know, it wasn't considered a place for, it's not, you got to look at the whole numbers, not just at the sports bar a block from the stadium, right? And how this all works.
Yeah, and don't you figure when they move them to Northern Indiana that they're going to, you know, there'll probably be a lot more bar business in Chicago because it'll be more difficult to go to games.
What do you mean? They're going to be the Indianapolis. They're going to be Indiana Bears.
Did you not see that Roger Goodall and the McCaskey and I have forgotten who the GM of the Bears is, but they toured three spots in northern Indiana, and some people caught them, you know, and posted pictures of them walking around, and I heard that a delegation was talking to the governor on Monday as well. So they're not just talking about this. They're actually taking action. And I think, you know, if the commissioner's down here looking at sites and talking about it, and one of the sites, it's really funny, it's kind of on the lake in northern Indiana, and on a clear day you can see Soldier Field. So, you know, they can maybe do a little thing with quarters where when people are at the northern Indiana Bears games, they can put a quarter in there and take a look at the old stadium.
Well, you know what you guys could do, since you are professors in Indiana, mm-hmm. if you want to put a knife in this, ask...
I don't want to put a knife in it. I think the best thing for the Bears is to move to northern Indiana.
Why is it? Well, if you want...
Because Illinois is a terrible state. Okay. And the Chicago city government is one of the worst. I mean, who do you want to deal with? You want to deal with somebody that's being very welcoming toward you, or a governor that says, we're not writing a check for you guys?
Well, why should they?
Well, if they don't want to and the other guys will, go to the guys that will.
Okay.
You know? I mean, Valentine's Day is coming up, and if I've got a couple of choices for dates, and one is coffee and one is, you know, a night at the Ritz-Carlton, I'm going to the Ritz-Carlton. And northern Indiana is the Ritz-Carlton for the Bears right now.
Okay. Go through the number.
I just want to throw in really quick that has nothing to do with the conversation, but for Valentine's Day, I'm making my traditional Valentine's turkey.
Really? Oh, yeah. Your kid, one of her kids loves turkey. That's the weirdest thing. In all seriousness, man, you know, if the, you know, you think you got things set in Arlington Heights and then they start to crap all over it, the city and the state, you know, are not trying to work with you. And Indiana is like got huge open arms for this thing. Plus, you got a lot of, you know, I both Larissa and I, doing the drive back and forth from Chicago, have had to get off and zigzag through Gary and those areas every once in a while. You could flatten it and put a giant stadium up, and you're not really going to upset anybody. And finally, and I think this is really how the thing's going to get done, you can gamble in northern Indiana. And if, you know, much like if you want to put together a giant sports complex with sports gambling and everything else and make it a destination spot that's not just going to host people, you know, 8 or 9 times a year, that's going to be an awesome place.
Read how much money the city of Gary has lost on the Railcat Stadium.
Yeah, well, I think the Railcats are a little bit, minor league baseball is a little bit different.
Name me a stadium anywhere in the last 40 years that the city's actually even been paid off on the stuff from
Superdome. Superdome was paid off, and then
Dallas probably is.
Yeah, no, I know Dallas, but I know the Superdome was one of the first instances where they had a specific tax to pay for it. And what they did was they had a nightly tax on hotel rooms.
Okay,
and that money went directly to pay for the Superdome.
I know, it,
and they were able to pay it off pretty quickly.
Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. Is a place ever paid for itself?
Well, it's been paid for with tourist money. I don't know if they've paid for themselves or not, but, you know, the point, really, it's not necessarily if it's going to pay for itself. If you're worried about the financials behind it, then you're happy with the Bears going to Indiana.
Okay, but I mean...
Because really, it comes down to a non-emotional, financial decision. You're going to northern Indiana.
Okay, we're going to go to break here in a second, but these things on the show tie together. Larissa, before you came on, we were talking about some inflation with Kevin and Larissa, and now we're talking about a inflation that's been huge for the last 5 or 6 years, correct? And everybody around is having property tax problems, all kinds of things. And the Bears, which are a family, maybe even a scummy family, that is making $220 million a year. None of that comes to you. None of it goes to me. None of it goes to Larissa. There's no we in Bears. The reason why the Arlington Park thing is falling apart, they want a 20 or 25 year hold on the taxes as they are now because the place is unimproved. Why would anybody get that? Why would we give that to anyone? Just ask it. Well, after break, you guys can give me your answer. That's the number. And now we have a president throwing out the Federal Reserve guy because he wants more money coming into the system. What do you think the dollar is going to be worth 20 years from now? And if they're and the taxes around them will be if theirs are frozen and nobody else's is. S&P futures down 28 and NASDAQ futures down 137. Be right back, Tax and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Lone Rope Bank, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howe. We have Andrew on the board. We have Russell Rhodes with us, and we have Dr. Edemiak with us. So it's good morning. We had Kevin. S&P futures down 25. NASDAQ futures down 127. Not too many people get two economists on one show. Two. S&P futures, like I say, they're down 26. We got gold and silver up. Silver, my God, is up another $4 today, $83. I know some people are taking their sterling silver in it and having people buy the stuff. I mean, I don't think anybody's at that stage, but who knows? Over in Europe, at the DAX down 103.4%. FTSE's actually up 38.4%. CAC around up 1, so call that flat. So we got a mixed bag over there. Over in Asia, the Nikkei up 792. Japanese stocks hit another record high as expectations of snap poll rise. They're going to try and get rid of their government over there. They have a snap election. I don't know if that's bullish or bearish. It'll be a Russell comment. He knows more about that area than me. Hang Seng up 151.5%. Shanghai down 12. That's 0.3%. So mixed, but to the upside over there. South Korea made a record yesterday, I believe. Bonds unchanged at 4.16. The Bund unchanged 2.80. Oil is up 73 cents. It's finally up over $60. 61.88. And don't let me get away without asking these guys. We're putting some people in the XLE for next year. I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm going to get our economic people to give me an idea there. Gold up $42, 46.41. Silver up 550, 91.86. I don't know. If silver goes to 100, that'll start of the year at like 30. That's really unreal. Dollar 1.16. So it's kind of where it's been against the euro, and 1.34. Actually, it's up a little. Pound was over 135 for a while, and the euro was over 117. So crypto up 690, 95,026. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right. It is 735 here in Chicago today. Basically nothing for sports, unless you got anything to add here.
Tuesday's a dead night.
Yeah, so nothing going on there. Chicago weather's a little bit more interesting. We're currently at 38 degrees, and temperatures are going to drop throughout the day as the wind speed increases. Also, currently looking outside the window, we can definitely see the effects of we are going to get an inch of snow through the next hour, and possibly a little bit of more, a tiny little scattered snow showers throughout the day. So it's not going to pile up too much, but it will reduce visibility. Over in Phoenix, they're keeping things simple. They are currently at 49 degrees. They're going to be sunny and warm. They're going to have a high of 79. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, there's one accident to report that's on the exit ramp of Dan Ryan heading east on 47th Street. Thankfully, no really big backups there. But for overall traffic, you got Kennedy from the Montrose to the Jane Burns. It's going to take you 24 minutes. Eden's from Lake Cook to the Jane Burns. It's going to take you 44. Eisenhower from Wolf to Jane Burns. It's going to take you 48. Stevenson from I-294 to Dan Ryan. It's going to take you 46. And Dan Ryan via the local lanes from 95th to Jane Burns. It's going to take you 39 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, what do you make of the snap election in Japan?
This is an easy one, and I'm gonna explain it to you in terms of the U.S. politics.
Okay.
Let's say, and please don't interrupt me because I know you're gonna when I say this, but let's just pretend like Trump has 70% popularity right now.
Okay.
And typically, you know, in midterms. You know, the ruling party loses a few seats. Well, the leader in Japan right now is so freaking popular that she's calling the snap election to try to increase the her presence in, you know, their parliament. So she's kind of taking advantage of her popularity. But the thing that I most definitely would read into this is she is a big old China hawk. And this might shore up more support for China being, you know, more favorable toward us and more cautionary toward China. She's been, you know, very, very aggressive toward them ever since she got elected. And they've, they've been making moves that China doesn't like. So I, you know, you right before the break, you said everything in this show relates to everything else. You know, the thing in Venezuela relates to China. The thing that's going on in Japan relates to what's going on in China as well.
Russell, so who did
that's
this?
That's what's up there.
Who did the snap election thing to solidify his popularity and it blew up on him? Was that France?
I feel like it was France.
Yeah, but something happened there.
There was one of them. And gosh, I can't remember. You know, everyone, when those things happen, your ex taps me to do a little commentary, and I can't remember. I feel like it was France.
Louis, I think
I do feel like it was a French election.
Somebody did that, and it was scheduled for like 3 months out, and then something weird happened in the 3 months, and the guy ended up losing seats or something, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it most definitely was France because the European volatility was really silly over those 2 or 3 months relative to U.S. volatility.
Okay, just as how this works, if the election is supposed to be, say, November, like here, and we decided to have a snap election, does that take the place of the November election? Or
yep.
Okay, so then...
Yep.
So then...
Okay. I've never fully understood how you can run a government like that.
Well, I don't either.
It just seems... I mean, our system seems messy. But that just seems that's always felt messier to me. You know, I'm not, she's not allowed to come on with us right now, but my daughter might be the one to really ask about this. So,
well, the systems are, I don't know if you and I talked about this once, and I think, Larissa, we'll spend a few minutes on this. You look at the UK system versus ours, you know, they can flip prime ministers a lot easier than we can flip presidents, right? I mean, because it's the party power that's their guy, right? But the rest of the government is actually way more stable than here, right? Because, I mean, in when a new president comes in, isn't there like 1,500 or 2,000 people that submit their resignations from State Department, Defense Department, and everything else? And a lot of them, the new president can either say, okay, you guys stay or don't, and you'll put your new people. And that's why the first year is always a huge mess of putting your people in versus the other people. Where in the UK, those are way more like lifelong positions. You know, the guy who's the ambassador to South America is somebody that speaks, you know, five dialects. That his whole life has been the study of South America, and you don't replace the guy. He lasts longer than the politicians. I don't know which is better, but it's kind of different. So if you flip a prime minister in the UK, you don't flip the whole government, kind of like you do here. I don't know. You guys...
I think that... I'm sorry, I know you were talking to Larissa, but I think that's a function of, you know, in the UK, they have, like, you know, the president has a cabinet.
Yeah.
Well, in the UK, the party that's in the minority will have a shadow cabinet. And if people are working for that shadow cabinet, I would assume that, you know, their status goes up and down based on who's in, you know, who's in charge there.
Right.
That's a guess around that, you know, just but both, you know, both parties over there have, you know, a Secretary of Defense, even though one doesn't really have much of a say of what's going on.
Yeah, I just thought if you had a Secretary of State, I would want that person, male or female, to be somebody who speaks eight languages and knows yeah. more about what's going on in the world than anybody on earth. Not just who happens to happen to be the president's flunky at the time, whoever the president is. It's, I don't know. It just seems.
Yeah, and I feel like we've got, I honestly feel like we have a mix of those people.
I think we do too. Larissa, what should I be buying this year? Oh, nobody wants to answer that question.
I said,
no,
I
we don't touch
shouldn't
it.
Be buying. You shouldn't be buying Goldman Sachs.
Well, that's a, boy, that's a true. Needless markup in the bankruptcy. What's going on with that?
It's not overly shocking.
No,
I think.
You know, brick and mortar's tough.
Yeah. Well, we have. We're not going to try and do individual stocks, but just an opinion. I mean, an opinion's this time of the year. I mean, they're up in the air. We had a lot of people. Matter of fact, I was talking to a guy last night, and he says, "How was your year?" And I said, "Well, it was really good for a lot of people because a lot of people who didn't want to be in some of the bigger stocks and so forth. We had a lot of people in the metals and in T-bills." And the guy goes, "Well, you must have had a great year in the metals." I go, "Yeah, we did. But if I was a real genius, I wouldn't have had anything in T-bills. I'd had all the metals, right?" There's always a way to improve. But now coming forward here, I don't know that I want to buy silver at 83. I mean, the stuff we have, we're kind of hanging on to, but. My brother's looking at oil. Last year we had a nice year. When I say we, the different clients that decide with us, because it's not all our decision, like what indexes they want to be in. We don't do a whole lot of individual stocks, although people have individual stocks. We had a nice year in the XLV. It was a clunker, and that's the healthcare piece of the S&P 500. It was a clunker for like 2 or 3 years, Russell, and all of a sudden this year it performed pretty well. My brother's thinking, I don't know if it's going to have another year like that or not. So we're starting this discussion by nobody knows what's going to happen this year, right? Now, the question is, out of all these different indices, the healthcare, the oil, the banks, do you guys like one or not like one? Or I don't know. I'm up. We're doing some in the XLE because I think the oil might creep up a little bit, but I don't know. I'm not all that. I don't think oil's going to be like $100 by the end of the year or anything. I don't really have a strong feeling in any of them, do you?
There's like some niche manufacturing firms that are benefiting tremendously from the AI build out.
I would agree.
And I've been, and it's almost like you need to look to the mid cap ones and not necessarily the large cap ones, because that's been the easy pickup money.
That's not been our base.
Something that's like manufacturing oriented, I almost would think.
So what's the manufacturing sector of the S&P? It's got to be one of the X's.
Bear with me. I got my Bloomberg up, so I'm trying to find it.
Well, Larissa, Lou says, I asked Lou about the defense industry, and he said there's a lot of smaller companies that do stuff for the defense industry. Well, two things about I'll find the email. I'll send it to you guys. You'll be stunned. The amount of combinations in the defense industry in the last 30 years or 40 years, Lou sent that to us. It's unbelievable. There were like 100 companies, and now there's like 10. I mean, the amount of combination. But he says there are some smaller companies that are involved in some of the software and a lot of the stuff. He goes, but they're kind of like not investable. They're at the level where maybe they're still owned by people. And Russell, do you do any of that? I mean, I don't see how I can get my clients into something like that. Do you know anything about that? Or Larissa, I mean, how can you get into a firm that's just barely going from ma and pa to their first... You know, maybe they have a defense contract, and all of a sudden they actually something going forward. I don't think I could ever get into that with my people. Do you guys know how to do that?
Russell, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I was gonna say, you and I talked recently about how the big structural change in the market, and it feels like companies skip being small caps.
Yeah.
And so there are fewer small cap opportunities out there. They stay private for a bit longer, and the emergence of private equity has kind of screwed up the ability to invest like that. The technology companies have their fingers in everything, and but what happens is if somebody comes up with something really novel, one of them buys it out very, very quickly. So you don't have a Google come out of nowhere and become a behemoth company. Google buys whatever is going to be the next Google. So it's very difficult to find the next, 10 bagger, because the private equity guys seem to be involved in those. You can look at investing with the private equity firms, but I don't know how well their run's going to go from here as well.
Well, you think when they buy these smaller firms that are doing well, Maybe it's a question for Larissa. Are they buying them to continue what they're doing, or are they buying them to squash them, or both? Or
I think they're buying them to continue what they're doing and to expand them.
Okay.
And to make sure the big company doesn't get squashed.
Yep.
Yeah. How's that?
Well, if you
it's
were
almost like, do you remember, was it Tyco?
Yeah.
I remember that name.
Conglomerate company, and their whole growth strategy was buying out firms. That was it. There was nothing else to that strategy. And I mean, it was quite successful for a long time, right?
You know why it was? You know the answer to this. The first major conglomerate was what, ITT? International Telephone and Telegraph, Harold Junian, way back. And then there was, remember Litton Industries, Russell? They were on the floor.
Yeah.
What were the other guys? LTV, Ling, Temco, Vought. Were they even in the U.S.? I don't remember those guys.
I don't remember that, but now you're getting too old for me.
Well, you know what they were able to do, Larissa, until somehow the leak? They would, if they bought a company for like, you know, $1 million and the book value was 500,000, they would take the 500,000 extra and put it into goodwill.
Right.
And actually take the goodwill as a profit.
Yep. I remember that.
And as soon as that accounting change got, they say you can't take that as a profit, you idiots. As soon as that happened, all of that stopped, didn't it? Wasn't it the accounting change?
The accounting was changed, but it took a long time for that accounting to change.
Right. Oh, yeah. It was because then they would depreciate the goodwill. So mm-hmm. as long as you kept buying places, even though you didn't make any money, it looked like you were making money.
And it was interesting. I had a friend who was an auditor for Tyco, and the materiality for what was audited. I think if it was less than $1 million, nobody looked at it. So you could be. Again, what an interesting way to continually grow profits. But I think the conglomerate idea is kind of coming back.
Yeah.
You can, if you kind of go through investment banking history, you can see trends toward breaking things up and then trends toward bringing things together. And it always seems like the bringing things together is toward market tops.
Yeah, it does. People
pay because it's hard to continue to grow, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to be able to get those higher growths, and it's a lot easier to buy growth than it is to develop growth yourself.
Well, why do you think, and Larissa, you're the one who's teaching the classes on this stuff, why do you think some firms are so good at managing all kinds of different businesses and some firms aren't? It's almost like they compete internally. When I look at
Think it's talent of management.
Well, in a Procter & Gamble, to me, they're my example. They manage to have, I'll say, 20 different serious products. They probably got 50. And yet every one of them, all the product lines seem to be managed without jealousy, without putting a chump in one spot and a good guy in another spot. Yet McDonald's, as good as they are at McDonald's, they've never been able to do that. They always, whenever they have another place, whether they intentionally don't grow it or whatever, and as soon as they let go, the thing takes off. I mean, some companies seem like they can do it and others can't.
I think it's the quality of the managers.
And that they don't mind people. It seems like there's a lack of jealousy or something. They don't mind if somebody does well, you know, in another area. I mean,
and it's part of that culture of the firm itself. And I think those are intangibles that's really difficult to measure. But it really does come down to the quality of who is managing the firm, what are their core values, and how are those core values being expressed to the rest of the firm.
I think that'd be really hard to do, I mean, over a long period of time, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's
one of the reasons why I don't think it's that replicable.
Yeah. Well, remember, back before that, when they had all the different car brands, General Motors was always trying to do that. They'd have... Like Pontiac could have, you know, two or three crummy years, and then they'd say, okay, we're putting our three best guys into Pontiac. And then over the next three or four years, Pontiac comes back, and now they're doing good, and Oldsmobile's doing lousy. Like, oh, no, we got to save Oldsmobile. And they would constantly move their best guys around to kind of the place that was doing the worst. And I don't know if they were ever very effective at it either. You know, it seemed like all they were doing was moving people around, but now they only have, what, Chevy and Cadillac, right, is the only thing that's left? Well, Buick's still there. So they've gone from 5 to 3. But I think it's hard. Don't, I mean, you imagine the jealousy and everything involved in there? Oh, you're getting all the money, the investment money, and I'm not. And can you imagine what those meetings are like?
It's one of the reasons why we study what's called agency theory in corporate
finance. Well, Larissa, we're going to put you, I know Russell actually does this, we're going to put you up on the stand. University of Chicago used to do this. My marketing professor was one of them, and the dean of the school. It was the, what was they call it? The business forecast luncheon, Russell? Wasn't that what it was? Where they put the three guys up there. Yeah. It was a real big deal. And I think you do that for Indiana, don't you, Russell?
I do that for Indiana. Well, yeah.
So what
we call it the future cast.
All right, so we're putting the Bodias up there. What do you think in 2026? Good year, bad year? Taxes up, taxes down? What do you think happens?
He put you on the pedestal.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
He was just talking to me, and then he handed it
sorry,
to you.
Sorry, that was...
Well, it sounds like neither one of you want to go first, but somebody has to.
I'm very cautious about this upcoming year. I am very concerned about whether or not we will have true expansion. There are some interesting policies that I'm hoping will take place, and I'm excited to see some of these things, such as Donald Trump putting a limit on credit card rates, and hopefully that will give relieve some pressure, which will hopefully stimulate the economy.
Any chance of that happening?
I hope.
I think there is. How do you? I mean, that's a bipartisan issue, man.
Yeah, I mean,
Elizabeth Warren has been calling for this for, you know, a decade. And I think this will be ultimate proof if, you know, people are actually willing to work with him on something that you know, it really, this is more of an other side of the aisle issue.
Okay.
Right. But it's also a logic issue. You know, he throws things out there like a, you know, for negotiation purposes. And I think he threw 10%. I think, you know, that might be like a first number. But, you know, something in the teens may end up being the cap. But, you know, this is you have complained about this issue for ever since I've been on here.
Okay. And by the way, I'm with you on this.
Yeah,
here's the history of it.
And I had a student ask. They said, "Are you you know, can they legally do this?" It came up in class yesterday, and I said, "I think they can. We've had interest rate laws in the past."
Okay, here's a little bit of the history of this, because you're right. This has been a big bone of contention to me forever, and I think we're in agreement on this. The states, and I'm going way back to when credit cards first came out. The states had usury laws. Illinois, I believe, was 12%. And the bank said, okay, the First National Bank said, well, we're going to, you know, they were still here. Continental was still here. And that's who you got your credit cards from. They said, oh, screw that. We're going to put a branch bank in the two states, I believe, were South Dakota and South Carolina, or North Carolina, one of the two. And all of a sudden, you're getting your credit cards. Why is this letter coming from North Carolina? It's a First National Bank. All of a sudden, the interest rate would be 15 or 20. It wasn't 30 back then. And they ended up getting a Supreme Court decision that essentially said, if the bank is from out of state, they're not held to the usury laws of Illinois, even if they're doing, if the person lives in Illinois. This was a Supreme Court decision, which to me, at the time, I said, this sucks, basically. I don't know where the hell they pulled that one out of their ass, but they did. So now Trump says, okay, we're going to be 10%. I don't know if I agree with the 10, but I'll roll with 15. But, I mean, I don't see how the hell that happens. Are we talking about a federal usury law? I'm asking you guys, how do you do it? You probably need a federal usury law. Is that in the cards?
Yeah, it would most definitely have to be a federal law.
And I don't think he can do it.
I don't think we've had one.
No, I don't think he can do it. I mean, it's not an executive order type of thing.
Oh, no. I think he has to work with Congress on it. And that's why I say this will be a,
this really will be a, you know, a indication if anybody is actually willing to work with him on something that benefits everybody and everybody kind of agrees on.
Well, I mean, even if even if the number is 25, I'm curious of the mechanism, how you get there. You know, I mean,
And I do think that, you know, credit card issuers are going to figure out some sort of a workaround. You know, if I'm got a $50 annual fee or something like that, it'll jump to 100.
Yeah.
So they're going to figure out how to get it one way or another. But, you know, the interest and you know, credit cards are what ends up just wiping people out because it's the last thing that they turn to when they're, you know, when they got to go to the grocery store and they got no other option.
Well, that's right.
So at least, you know, not charging 21% interest on, you know, a potato kind of makes sense to me.
Well, this is a Larissa question because she, out of all of us on the show, I think is more tied in with individual people because she teaches, and I'm not saying you don't teach, you know what I'm talking about here. I mean, more into family stuff. Why, Larissa, do people generally don't, again, I'm exaggerating here, If you want, you can probably go from credit union to credit union and find yourself a credit card that maybe won't pay you 1% back or 2% back that probably does have a 10 or 12% interest rate on it. And my guess is, and this is a question, my guess is the reason why people don't even look at the rate is they look at the 1% or 2% back. They say, I'm never going to carry a balance, so what the hell is the difference? And all of a sudden, something bad happens, a transmission or a broken ankle for a kid or something, and all of a sudden you're on there and you go, oh, my God, look at my thing. And all of a sudden, the other place at 10% doesn't want you. Am I anywhere near on the right page here or not?
I completely disagree with you.
Okay, fine. Good. So I asked, you're closer to this. I mean,
I believe it's the lack of financial literacy. I don't think people have any idea what that interest rate is and what it means.
Okay, I'll admit something to you.
They know it's bad.
I'll admit
they
something.
They know it's bad, but they don't really comprehend what is truly happening.
Can I admit something to you, Mom? if I get one in the mail and they're going to give me 5% back, I haven't had a balance in 10 years. I don't look at the rate. If they're going to give me something back, I'll take it. I mean, you know, if something happens, I'm right with everybody else. I mean,
And then you got to think of all these credit cards that offer 0% interest for the first year, and you have this enticing transfer all your debt over to this new credit card. They don't understand how interest is accumulating for that 1 year if you don't actually pay it off within that 1 year. It's one of those things that people genuinely don't understand how credit cards work. The lack of financial literacy amongst all populations in the United States is shocking. I think so. Russell and I are looking at senior citizens and senior citizen fraud. I want to say it's around 70% or 80% in the boomer generation who lack basic understanding of financial literacy. And that's the boomer generation. We're not even talking about the students that I'm working with who are obviously much, much younger. So it's across the board that people lack financial literacy.
Why is that? I mean,
we don't teach it.
I'll give you one.
Financial companies don't have an incentive for people to understand it.
Nope.
I don't. Last thing I want to do is one up my guess, but Audrey has had a couple of, and I'm not speaking out of school. I never talk about her stuff normally, but she's had a couple of clients that were in their early 30s. Both happen to be ladies, it doesn't matter, and had a nice job, were looking for their first house. They didn't have a bank account. And Audrey says, where the hell do you cash your check? Oh, I go to the currency exchange. She goes, you do what?
What do they charge you for that? What did they used to charge you at the currency exchange?
I'm sure they still charge. I mean, she goes, why don't you have a bank? Okay. Well, she goes, I don't really have a lot of money. She goes, it doesn't matter. That's where you should have your check going and everything else. What doesn't want to say what's the matter with you, but I think, Larissa, I think it's way worse than even you think. I that would be my guess. I don't think anybody has any idea how these numbers work.
Right? And there's a trust issue as well. There are certain part of the population that really does not trust banks.
or credit
you know,
union?
Let's say back in 2005, 2006, you get talked into a mortgage that you can't afford by a financial institution. And, you know, after everything fell apart, it took you 5 years just to get out of debt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, are you going to trust anything that somebody that, and they probably got talked into the mortgage by a non-banking financial institution, but the non-banking financial institutions look like banks to over half the public.
Right.
You know, they don't differentiate that much. So you've got, you know, a former bartender talking you into a mortgage that you can't afford. Once you get yourself together, you know, how much trust are you actually going to have in financial institutions? It's going to get shattered. And that's the thing that drives me nuts about situations like Bernie Madoff, et cetera. For our financial system to work, there's got to be a level of trust. And every time somebody breaks that trust, it makes it more difficult for the honest ones.
Well, you remember a gentleman named Marty O'Connell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Marty.
Yeah, Marty, great guy. Yeah. And brilliant man. And Larissa, he's a, you know, old Irish guy. We could tend to be direct. And he says to me, yeah, these Madoff people, they knew Bernie had an angle. They knew Bernie had a chump. They didn't realize they were the chump. I mean, pretty accurate, right? So Larissa, you have an amazing view. You know, I'm gonna take that and your disagreement. And I'm going to now say you were right and I was wrong. I'll do that. You know, because it's true. I mean, sometimes you're just wrong. You know, and I think you are. But how do we get out of high school? How do we get out of churches? You know, how does the church not have a class for, you know?
Well,
you know, I don't get it.
Hey, you brought up the high school thing. And Emmy's, you know, my youngest, her roommate at Purdue, her roommate's father lives out in New Jersey, but used to be a floor trader in Chicago. And he transitioned into being a high school teacher, and he is developing a high school finance class.
Well,
I've taught finance for non-business majors, and I shared all of that material with him to help him out on that. Because I feel like that's kind of the same level.
Get a load of this. I went to a funeral.
But there's a need for. There's definitely a need for that.
Huge need for it.
I went to a funeral. You say, how does this pile into anything? Well, the gentleman who died, he and my stepfather used to run the credit union at St. John Fisher, and there was a lot of people who used that credit union for car loans and everything else. And the young priest is given the homily, and he says, or eulogy, whatever you want to call it, and he goes, you know, I hear the guy's name was Fred Marabito, terrific guy. He goes, I hear Fred was involved in this like credit union thing, and he goes, why would anybody want a credit union at a church? And I'm looking at this priest going, what are you talking about? The credit union helped all these people home repair loans and car loans. Yeah, why would anybody want something like that? And I'm thinking, here's a younger guy, never took a finance class in his life. I mean, does Purdue have a big credit union? I bet they do, or Indiana?
We both do.
Yep.
Yeah. And is it very well, I'll use attended or used?
I cannot articulate. I
don't, but I know, and I haven't, just because I haven't, you know, permanently lived in Indiana until recently. But I know, you know, there's a huge branch in the student center, and there's usually, I mean, it's busy enough to exist. How's that?
Well, you know, I learned a little bit.
And, you know, it goes beyond. It goes to the hospital and a bunch of other. I mean, ours extends pretty dramatically.
Good for you. I mean, I was a professor at Notre Dame, guy's name was Croto, he's a character, but he was the only full professor at the time, and he wrote a book, The Economics of the Credit Union. And if you learn how a credit union works, it's just basic banking. You know, if you're paying people 3.5%, you better get enough good loans at 6.5%, or guess what? You're not going to have the money to pay people at 3.5%, right? I mean, nobody even thinks of that anymore, do they? You know, the government's got the money, or this is the money, or you're going somewhere, but isn't that basic banking?
It's supposed to be.
So, Larissa, you're in. You think it's going to be a... So, if you were investing, where would you be? Are you? I don't think anybody wants to buy long-term bonds at this point. Maybe you do. Short-term cash... what do you think of the metals here? Can you pile into silver at 83?
I will probably be as neutral as possible. I think that there's going to be overall low growth for 2026.
All right. Well, let me throw Russell a quick. We'll go over a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. Quick wrinkle at Russell. In my investment period where I've invested for other people, when I came off the trading floor in 2000, so I've been doing this for 25 years, we've had a couple of, I'll use the term, market tops. And in every one of the ones before, people were so complacent that the price of protection, meaning the VIX or the price of puts, implied volatility of the index, was very low. It was almost on record lows at the time. It was a record low month before the crash, 87. But in 2007, Larissa, we were the money manager of the year, PTI Securities, only because the puts were so cheap that when people put money in at the top, I extra hedged because they were like at a 9 vol and they were so cheap. I'm like, why don't I just buy a few extra? Well, now we're at 17. So all the people, and I've had some clients lately that have sent me a lot of individual stocks, concentration issues, which will do, and I'm pretty good at, but it's also very difficult, and I can see why other people don't do it. Russell, Larissa, the cost of these puts are to the moon. It is really hard to put some insurance on somebody's stuff right now, to the point where you almost want to question, do I really need 10,000 shares of one stock, you know, to where the price of insurance is to the moon. And the interest rates being where they are, it's really hard to cover them by the calls. I mean, we're doing some of the best trading we've ever done for people, and we're struggling to break even at it, even though the people, you know, everybody's protected. But this I've never seen a market top. Well, if this is the market top, where the puts are this high. So what do I do? Tell me, Professor.
You buy a 10% out of the money put, you sell a 20% out of the money put, you sell a 10% out of the money call.
Okay, so you're saying
that's what you do. When our buddy Marty Kearney, I always give him credit because I used to love when he would say this in our seminars. He'd go, "If you got to buy an expensive option, sell an expensive option."
Okay.
And sometimes that's the a collar, but like if you're not able to get the juice, as they put it, from the out of the money call that you're selling, you double down with maybe an out of the money put. And that 20% level, especially if you're talking about the indexes, is always a good level because that's where people, you know, start to talk about, all right, the correction is in, blah blah blah. So I've always found 20% out of the money is a good put to sell against a put that you buy.
I would say that's a pretty good number. What Russell's talking about is you're buying a piece of insurance. It's like saying if I have a $100,000 Mercedes, I'm going to buy 40 grand of collision insurance, figuring I'm not going to total it. Whatever I do to it, I can fix for 40, correct? Sort of the same thing. So in other words, if you look at an Apple, Apple's trading 260. If I want to buy the 260 puts, which means I can sell it at 260, I will sell the 220 puts because I think as far as down as it can go is 40, and I'm okay with that. Now, the problem with that is if it's 160, but you're betting that it isn't. Now, I'm not so sure with the market up here. There's a real 20% sounds better than 10 because somebody the other night I was talking to, they said sell the puts 10% out of the money, and I'm going, that's a little close. 20 sounds better. But you're essentially picking how low can we go when you do that, right?
Yeah. But you get partial protection, that helps you tremendously in that case. And you're not necessarily in one of those situations where you're being compared head to head with people, like on fund scoreboards and stuff. But the folks that are, those kind of strategies work very well for them because it gives them 1 or 2%, gap if we do get some sort of a sell-off, even though they didn't fully protect against the sell-off.
Well, and our last question for Larissa because we got a dash, but again, Larissa, you'll be the first one to tell me, I guess. It depends on the person. If it's Russell and he's obviously gainfully employed and doing well, if he has 1,000 shares of, say, Apple, I don't have any problem buying the 60 put, selling the 20 put, because down at 20, I'll buy a little more for him. Now, if it's Larissa, if it's your grandfather and he's retired and he's never going to work a day in his life, the only thing he's got is 5,000 in Apple, I'm not so sure I can make that decision that it can only go to 20. It's a difference in the person, right?
It's a difference in the risk tolerance.
Yes, which is what you're teaching, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And next time you're on, hopefully next week, I want to learn more about your class. Where are you starting? Are you starting with stocks, bonds, life issues, businesses? And we'll worry about that next week. Let me know, after you have a few classes under your belt, let me know how you're starting, because I'm real interested. And Russell, you have a good day. It is snowing to beat the band here. I don't know if downtown.
It's not doing anything down here yet, but I think it's.
Well, this is this lake effect thing. The wind must have turned this way a bit. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. SP Futures down 30, NASDAQ Futures down 157. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.